in her head, possibly for months. She'd been struggling with it alone, trying to keep her sanity by working through her visions in her artwork. Today she had been possessed by Python's voice and encircled by his poisonous fumes. Still, her first instinct was to reassure me that everything would be okay. "I wish you were right," I said. "But the longer Python controls Delphi, the more he can poison the future. Whether he twisted your words or not, they are now part of the prophecy. What you predicted will happen."
"Apollo's flesh and blood shall soon be mine."
The serpent's voice seemed to coil inside my head.
"Alone he must descend into the dark."
"Shut up," I told the voice. But I was not Meg, and Python was not my Lester. "Well then," Rachel said behind me, "we'll just have to make sure the prophecy happens in a way that doesn't get you dissolved." She made it sound so doable, so possible. "I don't deserve a priestess like you," I said. "No, you don't," Rachel agreed. "You can repay me by killing Python and getting the snake fumes out of my head." "Deal," I said, trying to believe I could hold up my side of the bargain. At last we reached the crane's central mast. Nico led us down the rungs of the ladder. My limbs shook with exhaustion. I was tempted to ask Meg if she could create another latticework of plants to carry us to the bottom, like she'd done at Sutro Tower. I decided against it, because, one, I didn't want her to pass out from the effort, and two, I really hated being tossed around by plants. By the time we reached the ground, I felt wobbly and nauseated. Nico didn't look much better. How he planned to summon enough energy to shadow zap us to safety, I couldn't imagine. Above us, around the rim of the pit, the Tauri watched in silence, their blue eyes gleaming like a string of angry Hanukkah lights. Meg studied them warily.
"Nico, how soon can you shadow us out?"
"Catch my breath first,"
he said between gulps of air.
"Please,"
Will agreed. "If he's too tired, he might teleport us into a vat of cheese whiz in Venezuela."
"Okay," said Nico. "We didn't end up in the vat."
"Pretty close," Will said. "Definitely in the middle of Venezuela's biggest cheese whiz processing plant."
"That was one time," Nico grumbled.
Guys?
Rachel pointed to the rim of the pit, where the cows were becoming agitated. They jostled and pushed each other forward until one, either by choice or with pressure from the herd, toppled off the edge. Watching it fall, kicking its legs and torquing its body, I remembered the time Ares dropped a cat from Mount Olympus to prove it would land on its feet in Manhattan. Athena had teleported the cat to safety, then beat Ares with the butt of her spear for putting the animal in danger. But the fall had been terrifying to witness, nonetheless. The bull was not as lucky as the cat. It landed sideways in the dirt with a throaty grunt. The impact would have killed most creatures, but the bull just flailed its legs, righted itself, and shook its horns. It glared at us as if to say, "Oh, you're gonna get it now."
Will edged backward. "It's in the pit, so why isn't it choking on its rage?" I think it's because we're here."
My voice sounded like I'd been sucking helium.
"It wants to kill us more than it wants to choke to death."
"Great," Meg said. "Nico, shadow travel, now."
Nico winced. "I can't take all of you at once. Two plus me is pushing it. Last summer with the Athena Parthenos, that almost killed me. And I had Raina's help."
The bull charged.
"Take Will and Rachel," I said,
hardly believing the words were coming out of my mouth.
"Return for Meg and me when you can."
Nico started to protest.
"Apollo's right," Meg said. "Go!"
We didn't wait for a response.
I drew my bow. Meg summoned her scimitars, and together we raced into battle.
There's an old saying. The definition of insanity is shooting an invulnerable cow in the face over and over and expecting a different result. I went insane. I shot arrow after arrow at the bull, aiming at its mouth, its eyes, its nostrils, hoping to find a soft spot. Meanwhile, Meg slashed and stabbed with gusto, weaving like a boxer to keep away from the creature's horns. Her blades were useless. The bull's shaggy red hide swirled and rippled, deflecting each hit. We only stayed alive because the bull couldn't decide which of us to kill first. It kept changing its mind and reversing course as we took turns annoying it. Perhaps if we kept up the pressure, we could tire out the bull. Sadly, we were also tiring out ourselves. And dozens more bulls waited above, curious to see how their friend fared before they risked the fall themselves.
"Pretty cow!"
Meg yelled, stabbing it in the face and then dancing out of horn range.
"Please go away!"
"It's having too much fun," I said. My next shot was the dreaded triple P, the perfect posterior perforator. It didn't seem to hurt the bull, but I definitely got its attention. The animal bellowed and whirled to face me, its blue eyes blazing with fury. While it studied me, probably deciding which of my limbs it wanted to pull off and beat me over the head with, Meg glanced at the rim of the pit.
Hey, Apollo?
I risked a look. A second bull tumbled into the pit. It landed on top of a portable toilet, crushing the box into a fiberglass pancake, then extracted itself from the wreckage and cried,
"Moo!"
Which I suspected was Tori for, "I totally meant to do that." "I'll take potty cow," I told Meg. "You distract our friend here." A completely random division of duties, in no way related to the fact that I did not want to face the bull I'd just poked in the nether region. Meg began dancing with Cow the First as I charged toward Potty Cow. I was feeling good, feeling heroic, until I reached for my quivers and found myself out of arrows. Except for Ye Old Standby, the arrow of Dodona, which would not appreciate being used against an invulnerable bovine butt. I was already committed, though. So I ran at Potty Cow with great bravado and zero clue how to fight it.
"Hey!"
I yelled, waving my arms in the dubious hope that I might look scary.
"Blah, blah, blah! Go away!"
The cow attacked. This would have been an excellent time for my godly strength to kick in, so of course that didn't happen. Just before the bull could run me down, I screamed and leaped aside. At that point, the bull should have executed a slow course correction, running around the entire perimeter of the pit to give me time to recover. I dated a matador in Madrid once who assured me bulls did this because they were courteous animals and also terrible at sharp turns. Either my matador was a liar, or he'd never fought Tori. The bull pivoted in a perfect about-face and charged me again. I rolled to one side, desperately grabbing for anything that might help me. I came up holding the edge of a blue polyurethane tarp. Worst shield ever. The bull promptly jabbed its horn through the material. I jumped back as it stepped on the tarp and got pulled down by its own weight, like a person stumbling over their own toga. Not that I had ever done this, but I'd heard stories. The bull roared, shaking its head to dislodge the tarp, which only got it more tangled up in the fabric. I retreated, trying to catch my breath. About 50 feet to my left, Meg was playing death tag with Cow the First. She looked unharmed, but I could tell she was tiring, her reaction time slowing. More cows began to fall into the pit like large, uncoordinated Acapulco cliff divers. I recalled something Dionysus had once told me about his twin sons, Castor and Pollux, back when he was living with his mortal wife during a short phase of domestic bliss.
He'd claimed that 2 was the best number for children, because after 2, your children outnumbered you. The same was true for killer cows. Meg and I could not hope to fend off more than a pair of them. Our only hope was... My eyes fixed on the mast of the crane. Meg, I yelled, back to the ladder. She tried to comply, but Cal the First stood between her and the crane. I whipped out my ukulele and ran in their direction. Cowie, cowie, cow, I strummed desperately. Hey, cow, bad cow, run away, cowie, cowie, cow. I doubted the tune would win any Grammys, but I was hoping it might at least distract Cal the First long enough for Meg to get around it. The cow stayed stubbornly put. So did Meg. I reached her side. I glanced back in time to see Potty Cow throw off the tarp and charge toward us. The newly fallen cows were also getting to their hooves. I estimated we had about 10 seconds to live. Go, I told Meg. Jump the cow and climb the ladder. I'll... I didn't know how to finish that statement. I'll stay here and die? I'll compose another verse of Cowie Cowie Cow? Just as Cow the First lowered its horns and charged, a hand grabbed my shoulder. Nico D'Angelo's voice said, Gotcha! And the world turned cold and dark. 16. Will Solace, healer, the hero we don't deserve. He has Kit Kat bars.
Jump the cow? Meg demanded. That was your plan?
The 5 of us sat in a sewer, which was something I'd grown accustomed to. Meg seemed to be bouncing back quickly from her shadow travel sickness, thanks to Will's timely administration of nectar and Kit Kat bars. I, however, still felt like I was coming down with the flu. Chills, body aches, disorientation. I was not ready to be assaulted for my choices in combat.
I was improvising, I said. I didn't want to see you die.
Meg threw her hands up.
And I didn't want to see you die, dummy. Did you think of that?
Guys, Rachel interrupted, a cold pack pressed against her head. How about none of us lets any of us die, okay? Will checked her bruised temple. Feeling any better?
I'll be fine,
Rachel said, then explained for my benefit. I managed to stumble into the wall when we teleported here. Nico looked sheepish.
Sorry about that.
Hey, I'm not complaining, Rachel said. Better than being trampled.
Guess so, he said. Once we...
Nico's eyelids fluttered. His pupils rolled up in his head and he slumped against Will's shoulder. It might have been a clever ploy to fall into his boyfriend's arms. I had used the catch-me-handsome fainting trick a few times myself. But since Nico immediately began to snore, I decided he was not faking. That's night-night for Nico. Will pulled a travel pillow from his supply bag, which I suspected he carried just for these occasions. He eased the son of Hades into a comfortable sleeping position, then gave us a weary smile. He'll need about 30 minutes to recover. Until then, we might as well make ourselves comfortable. On the bright side, I'd had plenty of experience getting comfortable in sewers, and Nico had shadow-traveled us to the New York drainage system's equivalent of the presidential suite. The vaulted ceiling was adorned with a red brick herringbone pattern. Along either wall, terracotta pipes dripped only the finest goo into a canal running down the middle of the floor. The concrete ledge upon which we sat was comfortably upholstered with lichen and scum. In the dim golden glow of Meg's swords, our only illumination, the tunnel looked almost romantic. Given New York rental prices, I imagined a place like this could go for quite a bit. Running water, privacy, lots of space, great bones. Mouse bones, chicken bones, and some others I couldn't identify. And did I mention the stench? The stench was included at no extra cost. Will tended to our various cuts and scrapes, which were surprisingly light given our morning's adventures. He insisted we partake liberally of his medicinal stockpile of Kit Kat bars. "The best thing for recovering from shadow travel," he assured us. Who was I to argue with the healing powers of chocolate and wafers? We ate in silence for a while. Rachel held the cold pack against her head and stared glumly at the sewer water, as if waiting for pieces of her family home to float by. Meg sprinkled seeds into the scum patches next to her, causing luminous mushrooms to pop into existence like tiny umbrellas. When life gives you scum, make mushrooms, I suppose. "Those forest bulls were amazing," Meg said after a while. "If you could train them to carry..." I groaned. "It was bad enough when you weaponized unicorns." "Yeah, that was great." She looked down the tunnel in both directions. "Does anyone know how we can get out of here?"
"Nico does."
Will's eye twitched. "Although he's not going to take us out so much as down."
"To the troglodytes," Rachel gasped.
"What are they like?" Will moved his hands as if trying to shape something out of clay or indicate the size of a fish he'd caught.
I can't describe them," he decided.
That wasn't reassuring. As my child, Will was bound to have some of my poetic ability. If the troglodytes defy description in your average sonnet or limerick, I didn't want to meet them.
"I hope they can help."
Rachel held up her palm to ward off Will, who was coming to check on her bruised head again.
"I'm okay now, thanks."
She smiled, but her voice was strained. I knew she liked Will. I also knew she had issues with personal space. Becoming the Pythia tended to do that to you. Having the power of Delphi possess your body and soul at random intervals could make you tetchy about people getting too close without your consent. Having Python whispering inside your head probably didn't help either.
"I get it," Will sat back. "You've had a rough morning. I'm sorry we brought that kind of trouble to your door."
Rachel shrugged.
"Like I said, I think I'm supposed to be in this trouble. It's not your fault. A dare reveals the path that was unknown. For once, I'm part of the prophecy."
She sounded strangely proud of this fact. Perhaps after issuing perilous quests for so many other people, Rachel found it nice to be included in our communal death wish adventure. People like to be seen, even if it's by the cold, cruel eyes of fate.
"Is it safe for you to come along, though?" Meg asked. "Like, if you've got Python in your head or whatever, won't he see what we're doing?"
Rachel pulled her ankles into a tighter crisscross.
"I don't think he's seeing through me. At least, not yet."
She let that idea settle around us like a layer of swamp gas.
"Anyway, you're not getting rid of me. Python has made this personal."
She glanced at me, and I couldn't escape the feeling that Python wasn't the one she really blamed. This had been personal for her ever since I'd accepted Rachel as my priestess. Ever since I'd been Apollo. If my trials as a mortal had done anything, they had shown me how many times I'd abandoned, forgotten, and failed my oracles over the centuries. I could not abandon Rachel in the same way. I'd neglected the basic truth that they did not serve me. I was supposed to serve them. "We're lucky to have you," I said. "I only wish we had more time to figure out a plan." Rachel checked her watch, a basic wind-up model, which she'd probably chosen after seeing how easily technology went haywire around demigods, monsters, and the other sorts of magical people she hung out with. "It's past lunchtime. You're supposed to surrender to Nero by nightfall. That doesn't give us much leeway."
"Oh, lunchtime," Meg said,
staying reliably on brand.
"Will, have you got anything besides Kit Kats? I'm starve."
She jerked her hand away from Will's supply kit as if it had shocked her. Why is there a tail sticking out of your bag?
Will furrowed his brow.
Oh, yeah.
He pulled out what appeared to be a foot-long desiccated lizard wrapped in a handkerchief.
Gross, Meg said with enthusiasm. Is that for medicine or something?
No, Will said. You remember how Nico and I went hunting for a gift for the Trogs? Well,
ick. Rachel scooted away. Why would they want that? Will glanced at me like, please don't make me say it. I shuddered.
The Troglodytes, if the legends are true, they consider lizards a great, you know.
I mimed putting something in my mouth.
Delicacy.
Rachel hugged her stomach.
Sorry I asked.
Cool, said Meg. So if we find the Trogs, we give them the lizard and they'll help us?
I doubt it will be that simple, I said. Meg, has anyone ever agreed to help you simply because you gave them a dead lizard?
She pondered the question so long it made me wonder about her past gift-giving practices.
I guess not.
Will slipped the desiccated animal back in his bag.
Well, this one is apparently rare and special. You don't want to know how difficult it was to find. Hopefully...
Nico snorted and began to stir.
What?
It's okay, Will reassured him. You're with friends.
Friends?
Nico sat up, bleary-eyed.
Friends.
Will gave us a warning look, as if suggesting we shouldn't startle Nico with any sudden moves. I gathered Nico was a grumpy napper like his father Hades. Wake up Hades prematurely and you were likely to end up as a nuclear blast shadow on his bedroom wall. Nico rubbed his eyes and frowned at me. I tried to look harmless.
Apollo, he said. Right. I remember.
Good, Will said. But you're still groggy. Have a Kit Kat.
Yes, doctor, Nico muttered.
We waited while Nico refreshed himself with chocolate and a swig of nectar.
Better.
He rose, still looking wobbly.
Okay, everybody. I'm going to lead you into the Troglodyte Caverns. Keep your hands away from your weapons at all times. Let me go first and do the talking. The Troglodytes can be a little... jumpy.
By jumpy, Will said, Nico means likely to murder us with no provocation.
That's what I said.
Nico popped the last of his Kit Kat in his mouth.
Ready. Let's do this.
Want directions to the Troglodyte Caverns? No problem. First you go down. Then you go down some more. Then you take the next 3 downward turns. You'll see a path going slightly up. Ignore that. Keep going down until your eardrums implode. Then go down even more. We crawled through pipes. We waded through slime pits. We navigated brick tunnels, stone tunnels, and dirt tunnels that looked like they had been excavated by the earthworm chew and poop method. At one point, we crawled through a copper pipe so narrow I feared we'd end up popping out of Nero's personal toilet, like a bunch of beauty queens emerging from a giant birthday cake. I imagined myself singing, "Happy birthday, Mr. Emperor," then quickly tamped down the thought. The sewer gas must have been making me delirious. After what seemed like hours of sewage-themed fun, we emerged in a circular room fashioned from panels of rough-hewn rock. In the center, a massive stalagmite erupted from the floor and pierced the ceiling like the center pole of a merry-go-round. After surviving Tarquin's Tilden Park carousel tomb, this was not a comparison I was pleased to make.
This is it, Nico said.
He led us to the base of the stalagmite. An opening had been chipped away in the floor just big enough for someone to crawl through. Handholds had been carved into the side of the stalagmite, extending down into the darkness. Is this part of the labyrinth? I asked.
The place had a similar feel. The air coming from below was warm and somehow alive, like the breath of a sleeping leviathan. I had the sense that something was monitoring our progress. Something intelligent and not necessarily friendly. Nico shook his head.
Please don't mention the labyrinth. The Trogs detest Daedalus's maze. They call it shallow. From here on down is all Trog built. We're deeper than the labyrinth has ever gone.
Awesome, Meg said. You can go ahead of me then, I said. We followed Nico down the side of the stalagmite into a massive natural cavern. I couldn't see the edges or even the bottom, but from the echoes I could tell it was bigger than my old temple at Didyma. Not to brag about temple size, but that place was huge. The handholds were shallow and slippery, illuminated only by faintly glowing patches of lichen on the rock. It took all my concentration not to fall. I suspected the Trogs had designed the entrance to their realm this way on purpose, so anyone foolish enough to invade would be forced to come down in single file, and might not make it to the bottom at all. The sounds of our breathing and our clinking supplies reverberated through the cave. Any number of hostiles could have been watching us as we descended, taking aim with all sorts of delightful missile weapons. Finally, we reached the floor. My legs ached. My fingers curled into arthritic claws. Rachel squinted into the gloom. What do we do now?
You guys stay behind me, Nico said. Will, can you do your thing? The barest minimum, please.
Wait. I said, what is Will's thing? Will kept his focus on Nico. Do I have to?
We can't use our weapons for light, Nico reminded him. And we'll need a little bit more, because the Trogs don't need any. I'd rather be able to see them.
Will wrinkled his nose. Fine. He set down his pack and stripped off his linen overshirt, leaving just his tank top. I still had no idea what he was doing, though the girls didn't seem to mind letting him do his thing. Did Will keep a concealed flashlight in his undershirt? Was he going to provide light by rubbing lichen on himself and smiling brilliantly? Whatever the case, I wasn't sure I wanted to see the Trogs. I vaguely recalled a British invasion band from the 1960s called the Trogs. I couldn't shake the feeling that this subterranean race might all have mop-top hairdos and black turtlenecks and would use the word groovy a lot. I did not need that level of horror in my life. Will took a deep breath. When he exhaled, I thought my eyes were playing tricks on me. We'd been in near total darkness so long, I wasn't sure why Will's outline suddenly seemed clearer. I could see the texture of his jeans, the individual tufts of his hair, the blue of his eyes. His skin was glowing with a soft, warm golden light, as if he'd ingested sunshine.
Whoa, Meg said.
Rachel's eyebrows floated toward her hairline. Nico smirked.
Friends, meet my glow-in-the-dark boyfriend.
Could you not make a big deal about it? Will asked. I was speechless. How could anyone not make a big deal about this? As far as demigod powers went, glowing in the dark was perhaps not as showy as skeleton summoning or tomato vine mastery, but it was still impressive. And, like Will's skill at healing, it was gentle, useful, and exactly what we needed in a pinch. I'm so proud, I said. Will's face turned the color of sunlight shining through a glass of cranberry juice.
Dad, I'm just glowing. I'm not graduating at the top of my class.
I'll be proud when you do that, too, I assured him.
Anyway,
Nico's lips quivered like he was trying not to giggle.
I'll call the cavern runners now. Everybody stay calm, okay?
Why are they called cavern runners? Rachel asked. Nico held up his hand, indicating, wait, or you're about to find out. He faced the darkness and shouted,
"Troglodytes! I am Nico D'Angelo, son of Hades. I have returned with 4 companions."
Shuffling and clicking filled the cavern, as if Nico's voice had dislodged 1,000,000 bats. One moment we were alone. The next moment, an army of troglodytes stood before us, as if they'd materialized out of hyperspace. With unsettling certainty, I realized they had run here from wherever they'd been. Yards away, miles away, with speed that rivaled that of Hermes himself. Nico's warnings suddenly made sense to me. These creatures were so fast they could have killed us before we had time to draw a breath. If I'd had a weapon in hand, and if I'd raised it instinctively, accidentally, I would now be the grease spot, formerly known as Lester, formerly known as Apollo. The troglodytes looked even stranger than the 1960s band that had appropriated their name. They were small humanoids, the tallest barely Meg's height, with vaguely frog-like features, wide, thin mouths, recessed noses, and giant, brown, heavily lidded orbs for eyes. Their skin came in every shade from obsidian to chalk. Bits of stone and moss decorated their dark, plaited hair. They wore a riot of clothing styles, from modern jeans and t-shirts to 1920s business suits, to colonial-era frilly shirts and silk waistcoats. The real showstopper, however, was their selection of hats. Some piled 3 or 4 high on their heads. Tricorns, bowlers, racing caps, top hats, hard hats, ski caps, and baseball caps. The trogs looked like a group of rowdy schoolchildren who'd been set loose in a costume store, told to try on whatever they wanted, and then allowed to crawl through the mud in their new outfits.
"We see you, Nico D'Angelo,"
said a trog in a miniature George Washington costume. His speech was interspersed with clicks, screeches, and growls, so it actually sounded like,
"We can see you, Nico D'Angelo."
George Washingtrog gave us a pointy-toothed grin.
"Are these the sacrifices you promised? The trogs are hungry."
17. Speak to me of soup, let it be savory broth, with a hint of skink. My life didn't flash before my eyes, but I did find myself reviewing the past for anything I might have done to offend Nico D'Angelo. I imagined him saying,
"Yes, these are the sacrifices."
Then taking Will's hand and skipping away into the darkness, while Rachel, Meg, and I were devoured by an army of costumed, muddy miniature frogmen.
"These are not the sacrifices," Nico said, allowing me to breathe again. "But I have brought you a better offering. I see you, O great Screech Bling."
Nico did not say screech, mind you. He screeched in a way that told me he'd been practicing troglodytish. He had a lovely, ear-piercing accent. The trogs leaned in, sniffing and waiting, while Nico held out his hand to Will like, "Gimme." Will reached into his bag. He pulled out the desiccated lizard and handed it to Nico, who unwrapped it like a holy relic and held it aloft. The crowd let out a collective gasp. Screech Bling's nostrils quivered. I thought his tricorn hat might pop off his head from excitement.
"Is that a 5-lined skink?"
"It is," Nico said. "This was difficult to find. Bling, wearer of the finest hats." Bling licked his lips. He was drooling all over his cravat.
"A rare gift indeed. We often find Italian wall lizards in our domain." turtles, wood frogs, rat snakes. Occasionally, if we are very lucky, a pit viper. Tasty,
shrieked a trog in the back.
Tasty pit vipers!
Several other trogs screeched and growled in agreement.
But a five-lined skink, rah,
Bling said,
is a delicacy we seldom see.
My gift to you, Nico said, a peace offering in hope of friendship.
Rah,
Bling took the skink in his long-fingered, pointy-clawed hands. I assumed he would shove the reptile in his mouth and be done with it. That's what any king or god would do, presented with his favorite delicacy. Instead, he turned to his people and made a short speech in their own language. The trogs cheered and waved their chapeaus. A trog in a mud-splattered chef's hat pushed his way to the front of the crowd. He knelt before Rah, Bling and accepted the skink. The chieftain turned to us with a grin.
We will share this bounty. I, Rah, Bling, chief executive, officer of the troglodytes, have decreed that a great soup shall be made so that all shareholders may taste of the wondrous skink.
More cheering from the troglodytes. Of course, I realized. If
Rah,
Bling modeled himself after George Washington, he would not be a king. He would be a chief executive.
For this great gift,
he continued,
we will not kill and eat you, Nico D'Angelo, even though you are Italian, and we wonder if you might taste as good as an Italian wall lizard.
Nico bowed his head.
That is very kind.
We will also generously refrain from eating your companions.
A few of Bling's shareholders muttered,
ah, what? Though it is true that, like you, they do not wear hats, and no hatless species can be considered civilized.
Rachel and Meg looked alarmed. Probably because Bling was still drooling profusely as he talked about not eating us. Or perhaps they were thinking about all the great hats they could have worn if they'd only known. Glow-in-the-dark Will gave us a reassuring nod and mouthed, it's cool. Apparently the giving of a gift, followed by the promise of not killing and eating your guests, was standard troglodyte diplomatic protocol.
We see your generosity. Oh, Bling,
Nico said.
I would propose a pact between us, an agreement that would produce many hats for us all, as well as reptiles, fine clothing, and rocks.
An excited murmur rippled through the crowd. It seemed Nico had hit upon all four things on the troglodytes' Christmas wish list. Bling summoned forward a few senior trogs, who I guessed were his board of directors. One was the chef. The others wore the hats of a police officer, a firefighter, and a cowboy. After a short consultation, Bling faced us with another pointy-toothed grin.
Very well, he said. We will take you to our corporate headquarters, where we will feast upon skink soup and talk more about these matters.
We were surrounded by a throng of cheering, growling shareholders. With a total lack of regard for personal space, as one might expect from a tunnel-dwelling species, they picked us up and ran with us on their shoulders, sweeping us out of the cavern and into a maze of tunnels at a speed that would have put the Tauri Silvestris to shame.
These guys are awesome,
Meg decided.
They eat snakes.
I knew several snakes, including Hermes' companions, George and Martha, who would have been uncomfortable with Meg's definition of awesomeness. Since we were now in the midst of the Trog's encampment, I decided not to bring that up. At first glance, the troglodytes' corporate headquarters resembled an abandoned subway station. The wide platform was lined with columns holding up a barreled ceiling of black tiles that drank in the dim light from pots of bioluminescent mushrooms scattered around the cavern. Along the left side of the platform, instead of a rail bed, was the sunken, packed earth roadway that the Trogs had used to bring us here. And at the speeds they ran, who needed a train? Along the right side of the platform flowed a swift subterranean river. The Trogs filled their gourds and cauldrons from this source, and also emptied their chamber pots into it. Though, being a civilized hat-wearing people, they dumped the chamber pots downstream from where they drew their drinking water. Unlike in a subway station, there were no obvious stairways leading up, no clearly marked exits, just the river and the road we'd arrived on. The platform buzzed with activity. Dozens of Trogs rushed here and there, miraculously managing their daily chores without losing the stacks of hats on their heads. Some tended cooking pots on tripods over fire pits. Others, possibly merchants, haggled over bins of rocks. Trog children, no bigger than human babies, frolicked around, playing catch with spheres of solid crystal. Their dwellings were tents. Most had been appropriated from the human world, which gave me unpleasant flashbacks of the camping display at Macro's Military Madness in Palm Springs. Others appeared to be of Trog design, carefully stitched from the shaggy red hides of the Tauri Silvestris. I had no idea how the Trogs had managed to skin and stitch the impervious hides, but clearly, as the ancestral enemies of the forest bulls, they had found a way. I wondered about that rivalry, too. How had a subterranean frog people in love with hats and lizards become mortal enemies to a breed of bright red devil bulls? Perhaps at the beginning of time, the elder gods had told the first Trogs, "You may now pick your nemesis." And the first Trogs had pointed across the newly made fields of creation and yelled, "We hate those cows!" Whatever the case, I was comforted to know that even if the Trogs were not yet our friends, at least we had a mutual enemy. Rah! Bling had given us a guest tent and a cold fire pit, and told us to make ourselves at home while he saw to dinner preparations. Or rather, he'd told Nico to make himself at home. The CEO kept eyeing Rachel, Meg, and me like we were sides of beef hanging in a shop window. As for Will, the troglodytes seemed to ignore him. My best guess, because Will glowed, they considered him simply a movable light source, as if Nico had brought along his own pot of luminous mushrooms. Judging from Will's scowl, he did not appreciate this. It would have been easier to relax if Rachel hadn't kept checking her watch, reminding us that it was now 4 in the afternoon, then 4:30, and that Meg and I were supposed to surrender by sundown. I could only hope the troglodytes were like senior citizens and ate supper early. Meg busied herself collecting spores from the nearby mushroom pots, which she seemed to consider the coolest thing since snake eating. Will and Nico sat on the other side of the fire pit, having a tense discussion. I couldn't hear the words, but from their facial expressions and hand gestures, I got the gist. Will: "Worry, worry, worry." Nico: "Calm down, probably won't die." Will: "Worry, Trogs, dangerous, yikes." Nico: "Trogs good, nice hats." Or something along those lines. After a while, the Trog with the chef's hat materialized at our campsite. In his hand was a steaming ladle.
"Bling will talk to you now,"
he said in heavily troglodytish-laced English. We all began to rise, but the chef stopped us with a sweep of his ladle.
"Only Nico, the Italian wall lizard. I mean, the Italian son of Hades. The rest of you will wait here until dinner."
His gleaming eyes seemed to add,
"When you may or may not be on the menu."
Nico squeezed Will's hand.
"It'll be fine. Back soon."
Then he and the chef were gone. In exasperation, Will threw himself down on his fireside mat and put his backpack over his face, reducing our Will Glow illumination by about 50%. Rachel scanned the encampment, her eyes glittering in the gloom. I wondered what she saw with her ultra-clear vision. Perhaps the troglodytes looked even scarier than I realized. Perhaps their hats were even more magnificent. Whatever the case, her shoulders curved as tense as a drawn bow. Her fingers traced the soot-stained floor as if she were itching for her paintbrushes. "When you surrender to Nero," she told me, "the first thing you'll need to do is buy us time." Her tone disturbed me almost as much as her words. "When I surrendered, not if." Rachel had accepted that it was the only way. The reality of my predicament curled up and nestled in my throat like a five-lined skink. I nodded. "Buy time. Yes. Nero will want to burn down New York as soon as he has you," she said. "Why would he wait? Unless you give him a reason." I had a feeling I would not like Rachel's next suggestion. I didn't have a clear understanding of what Nero intended to do to me once I surrendered, other than the obvious torture and death. Lugusselwa seemed to believe the Emperor would keep Meg and me alive, at least for a while, though she had been vague about what she knew of Nero's plans. Commodus had wanted to make a public spectacle out of my death. Caligula had wanted to extract what remained of my godhood and add it to his own power with the help of Medea's sorcery. Nero might have similar ideas. Or, and I feared this was most likely, once he finished torturing me, he might surrender me to Python to seal their alliance. No doubt my old reptilian enemy would enjoy swallowing me whole, letting me die in his belly over the course of many excruciating days of digestion. So, there was that to look forward to. What reason would make Nero wait? I asked. Apparently, I was picking up troglodytish because my voice was punctuated by clicks and squeaks. Rachel traced curlicues in the soot. Waves, perhaps, or a line of people's heads. "You said Camp Half-Blood was standing by to help?" "Yes. Kayla and Austin told me they would remain on alert. Chiron should be back at camp soon as well. But an attack on Nero's tower would be doomed. The whole point of our surrender is to distract the Emperor from what Nico, Will, and I will be doing. Hopefully with the Trog's help. Disabling the Greek fire vats. But you'll need to give Nero another incentive to keep him from pushing that button the minute you surrender. Otherwise, we'll never have time to sabotage his doomsday weapon, no matter how fast the Trogs can run or dig." I understood what she was suggesting. The five-lined skink of reality began its slow, painful slide down my esophagus. "You want to alert Camp Half-Blood," I said. "Have them initiate an attack anyway. Despite the risks." "I don't want any of this," she said, "but it's the only way. It'll have to be carefully timed. You and Meg surrender. We get to work with the troglodytes. Camp Half-Blood musters for an attack. But if Nero thinks the entire camp is coming to him, that would be worth waiting for. To take out the entire population of Camp Half-Blood while he destroys the city, all in one terrible firestorm." I swallowed. "I could just bluff. I could claim reinforcements are coming." "No," Rachel said. "It has to be real. Nero has Python on his side. Python would know." I didn't bother asking her how. The monster might not have been able to see through Rachel's eyes yet. But I remembered all too well how his voice had sounded speaking through her mouth. They were connected, and that connection was getting stronger. I was reluctant to consider the details of such an insane plan, but I found myself asking, "How would you alert the camp?" Rachel gave me a thin smile. "I can use cell phones. I don't normally carry one, but I'm not a demigod. Assuming I make it back to the surface, where cell phones actually, you know, work, I can buy a cheap one. Chiron has a crappy old computer in the big house. He hardly ever uses it, but he knows to look for messages or emails in emergency situations. I'm pretty sure I can get his attention, assuming he's there. She sounded so calm, which just made me feel more agitated. Rachel, I'm scared, I admitted. It was one thing thinking about putting myself in danger, but the entire camp, everyone. Strangely, this comment seemed to please her. She took my hand. I know, Apollo. And the fact that you're worried about other people, that's beautiful. But you'll have to trust me. That secret path to the throne. The thing I am supposed to show you. I'm pretty sure this is it. This is how we make things right. Make things right. What would such an ending even look like? 6 months ago, when I first plummeted to Manhattan, the answer had seemed obvious. I would return to Mount Olympus, my immortality restored, and everything would be great. After being Lester for a few more months, I might have added that destroying the Triumvirate and freeing the ancient oracles would also be good, but mostly because that was the path back to my godhood. Now, after all the sacrifices I had seen, the pain suffered by so many, what could possibly make things right? No amount of success would bring back Jason, or Dakota, or Don, or Crest, or Moneymaker, or Heloise, or the many other heroes who had fallen. We could not undo those tragedies. Mortals and gods had one thing in common. We were notoriously nostalgic for the good old days. We were always looking back to some magical golden time before everything went bad. I remembered sitting with Socrates back around 425 BCE and griping to each other about how the younger generations were ruining civilization. As an immortal, of course, I should have known that there never were any good old days. The problems humans face never really change, because mortals bring their own baggage with them. The same is true of gods. I wanted to go back to a time before all the sacrifices had been made, before I had experienced so much pain. But making things right could not mean rewinding the clock. Even Kronos hadn't had that much power over time. I suspected that wasn't what Jason Grace would want either. When he'd told me to remember being human, he'd meant building on pain and tragedy, overcoming it, learning from it. That was something gods never did. We just complained. To be human is to move forward, to adapt, to believe in your ability to make things better. That is the only way to make the pain and sacrifice mean something. I met Rachel's gaze. I trust you. I'll make things right. Or I will die trying. The strange thing was, I meant it. A world in which the future was controlled by a giant reptile, where hope was suffocated, where heroes sacrificed their lives for nothing, and pain and hardship could not yield a better life. That seemed much worse than a world without Apollo. Rachel kissed my cheek, a sisterly gesture. Except it was hard to imagine my actual sister Artemis doing that. I'm proud of you, Rachel said. Whatever happens, remember that. I was tongue-tied. Meg turned toward us, her hands full of lichen and mushrooms.
Rachel, did you just kiss him? Ew, why?
Before Rachel could answer, the chef reappeared at our campsite, his apron and hat splattered with steaming broth. He still had that hungry glint in his eyes.
Visitors! Come with me. We are ready for the feast!
18. Our special tonight, a lovely braised Apollo. Under a Mets hat. My advice. If you're ever given a choice between drinking skink soup or serving yourself up as the troglodyte's main course, just flip a coin. Neither option is survivable. We sat on cushions around a communal mushroom pit with 100 or so troglodytes. As barbarian guests, we were each given headwear, so as not to offend our host's sensibilities. Meg wore a beekeeper's hat. Rachel got a pith helmet. I was given a New York Mets cap because, I was told, no one else wanted it. I found this insulting both to me and the franchise. Nico and Will sat on Bling's right. Nico sported a top hat, which worked well with his black and white aesthetic. Will, my poor boy, had been given a lampshade. No respect for the lightbringers of the world. Sitting to my left was the chef, who introduced himself as Warong. Pronounce the W. His name made me wonder if he'd been an impulse buy for his parents on Cyber Monday. But I thought it would be rude to inquire. The Trog children had the job of serving. A tiny boy in a propeller beanie offered me a black stone cup filled to the brim, then ran away giggling. The soup bubbled a rich golden brown.
The secret is lots of turmeric,
Warong confided. Ah, I raised my cup, as everyone else was doing. The Trogs began slurping with blissful expressions, and many
rawr,
and yummy sounds. The smell was not bad, like tangy chicken broth. Then I spotted a lizard foot floating in the foam, and I just couldn't. I pressed my lips to the rim and pretended to sip. I waited for what I thought was a credible amount of time, allowing most of the Trogs to finish their portions. Mmm, I said. Warong, your culinary skills astound me. Partaking in this soup is a great honor. In fact, having any more of it would be too much of an honor. May I give the rest to someone who can better appreciate the succulent flavors?
Me,
shouted a nearby Trog.
Me,
shouted another. I passed the cup down the circle, where it was soon drained by happy troglodytes. Warong did not appear insulted. He patted my shoulder sympathetically.
I remember my first skink. It is a potent soup. You will be able to handle more next time.
I was glad to hear he thought there would be a next time. It implied we would not be killed this time. Rachel, looking relieved, announced that she too was overwhelmed with honor and would be happy to share her portion. I looked at Meg's bowl, which was already empty. Did you actually...
What?
Her expression was unreadable behind the netting of her beekeeper's hat. Nothing. My stomach convulsed with a combination of nausea and hunger. I wondered if we would be honored with a second course. Perhaps some breadsticks, or really anything that wasn't garnished with skink feet. Bling raised his hands and... for attention.
Friends, shareholders, I see you all.
The troglodytes tapped their spoons against their stone cups, making a sound like a thousand clattering bones.
Out of courtesy for our uncivilized guests.
Bling continued.
I shall speak in the barbaric language of the crust dwellers.
Nico tipped his fine top hat. I see the honor you give us. Thank you, CEO. Bling, for not eating us. And also speaking in our tongue. Bling nodded with a smug expression that said, No problem, kid. We're just awesome that way.
The Italian wall lizard has told us many things.
A board member standing behind him, the one with the cowboy hat, whispered in his ear.
I mean, the Italian son of Hades, Bling corrected. He has explained the evil plans of Emperor Nyakro.
The Trogs muttered and hissed. Apparently, Nero's infamy had spread even to the deepest-dwelling corporations of hatwearers.
Rah!
Bling pronounced the name
Nyakro,
with a sound in the middle like a cat being strangled, which seemed appropriate.
The son of Hades wishes our help, said Rah!
Bling.
The Emperor has vats of fire liquid. Many of you know the ones I speak of. Loud and clumsy was the digging when they installed those vats. Shoddy the workmanship.
Shoddy,
agreed many of the Trogs.
Soon, said the CEO, Nyakro will unleash burning death across the crusty crust. The son of Hades has asked our help to dig to these vats and eat them.
You mean disable them? Nico suggested.
Yes, that!
Bling agreed.
Your language is crude and difficult.
On the opposite side of the circle, the board member with the police hat made a small, notice-me sort of growl.
Oh, hey, Bling! These fires will not reach us. We are too deep. Should we not let the crusty crust burn?
Hey! Will spoke for the first time, looking about as serious as someone can while wearing a lampshade. We're talking about millions of innocent lives. Police Hat snarled.
We Trogs are only hundreds. We do not breed and breed and choke the world with our waste. Our lives are rare and precious. You crust dwellers, no. Besides, you are blind to our existence. You would not help us.
Fred speaks the truth, said Cowboy Hat. No offense to our guests.
The child with the propeller beanie chose this moment to appear at my side, grinning and offering me a wicker basket covered by a napkin.
Breadsticks?
I was so upset I declined.
Assure our guests,
Bling was saying.
We have welcomed you to our table. We see you as intelligent beings. You must not think we are against your kind. We bear you no ill will. We simply do not care whether you live or die.
There was a general muttering of agreement. Wurong gave me a kindly glance that implied, you can't argue with that logic. The scary thing was, back when I was a god, I might have agreed with the Trogs. I'd destroyed a few cities myself in the old days. Humans always popped up again like weeds. Why fret about one little fiery apocalypse in New York? Now, though, one of those not-so-rare lives was Estelle Blofus's. Giggler and future ruler of the Krusty Krust, and her parents, Sally and Paul. In fact, there wasn't a single mortal I considered expendable. Not one deserved to be snuffed out by Nero's cruelty. The revelation stunned me. I had become a human life hoarder. It's not just crust dwellers, Nico was saying, his tone remarkably calm. Lizards, skinks, frogs, snakes. Your food supply will burn. This caused some uneasy mumbling, but I sensed that the Trogs were still not swayed. They might have to range as far as New Jersey or Long Island to gather their reptiles. They might have to live on breadsticks for a while. But so what? The threat wasn't critical to their lives or their stock prices.
What about hats? Will asked. How many haberdasheries will burn if we don't stop Nero? Dead haberdashers cannot make Trog haberdashery.
More grumbling, but clearly this argument wasn't enough either. With a growing sense of helplessness, I realized that we wouldn't be able to convince the troglodytes by appealing to their self-interest. If only a few hundred of them existed, why should they gamble their own lives by tunneling into Nero's Doomsday Reservoir? No god or corporation would accept that level of risk. Before I realized what I was doing, I had risen to my feet.
Stop! Hear me, troglodytes!
The crowd grew dangerously still. Hundreds of large brown eyes fixed on me. One trog whispered,
"Who is that?"
His companion whispered back,
"Don't know, but he can't be important. He's wearing a Mets hat."
Nico gave me an urgent, "Sit down before you get us killed" look.
"Friends," I said, "this is not about reptiles and hats."
The trogs gasped. I had just implied that two of their favorite things were no more important than crust-dweller lives. I forged ahead.
"The trogs are civilized. But what makes a people civilized?"
"Hats!"
yelled one.
"Language!"
yelled another.
"Soup?"
inquired a third.
"You can see," I said. "That is how you greeted us. You saw the son of Hades. And I don't mean just seeing with your eyes. You see value and honor and worthiness. You see things as they are. Is this not true?"
The trogs nodded reluctantly,